No war can be conducted successfully without early and good intelligence, wrote the great Duke of Marlborough. No sensible soldier or sailor or airman does argue. From the earliest times, military leaders have always sought information of the enemy, his strengths, his weaknesses, his intentions, his dispositions. Alexander the Great, presiding at the Macedonian court as a boy, was remembered by visitors from the lands he would later conquer for his persistence in questioning them about the size of the population of their territory, the productiveness of the soil, the course of the routes and rivers that crossed it, the location of its towns, harbours and strong places, the identity of the important men. The young Alexander was assembling what today would be called economic, regional, or strategic intelligence, and the knowledge he accumulated served him well when he began his invasion of the Persian Empire, enormous in extent and widely diverse in composition. Alexander triumphed because he brought to his battlefields a ferocious fighting force of tribal warriors personally devoted to the Macedonian monarchy. But he also picked the Persian Empire to pieces, attacking at its weak points and exploiting its internal divisions. The strategy of divide and conquer, usually based on regional intelligence, underlay many of the greatest exploits of empire building. Not all. The Mongols preferred terror, counting on the word of their approach to dissolve resistance. If duplicity enhanced their terrible reputation, so much the better. In 1258, appearing out of the desert, Hulagu promised the caliph, spiritual leader of Islam, ruler of the Muslim Empire, his life if he would surrender Baghdad. As soon as he submitted, he was strangled and the horde moved on. The Mongols, however, as a wide-ranging nomad people, also knew a great deal, and like all nomads, when not on campaign, were always ready to trade. Markets are principal centers for the exchange of information, as well as goods, and it was often a demand of marauders, by the Huns, of the Romans, frequently by the Vikings, that they should be allowed to set up markets on the borders of settled lands. Commerce was commonly the prelude to predation. Trade may follow the flag, as the Victorians comfortably affirmed, but it was quite as often the other way about. Whether on the decline or in the ascendant, however, Rome devoted great care to the gathering of intelligence. Caesar's conquest of Gaul was as much the result of his superior use of intelligence as the legion's superior fighting power. He took great trouble to assemble economic and regional intelligence, just as Alexander had done, and he was a coldly cynical assessor of the Gauls' ethnic defects, their boastfulness, volatility, unreliability, lack of resilience. He was equally cold in exploiting the advantage his knowledge of their weaknesses afforded. He accumulated a detailed ethnographic knowledge of their tribal characteristics and divisions, which he used ruthlessly to defeat them. Quite apart from this strategic intelligence, however, he also had a highly developed system of tactical intelligence, using short and medium-range units of scouts to reconnoitre up to 30 kilometres in advance of his main body, to spy out the land and the enemy's dispositions when he proceeded on campaign. It was an important principle that the leaders of these units had immediate and direct access to his person. Caesar did not invent the Roman system of intelligence. It was the product of several hundred years of military experience. Evidence for that is already given by the time of the Gallic Wars, 1st century BC, by the existence of established terms for the different categories of reconnaissance troops. Procursatores, who performed close reconnaissance immediately ahead of the army, exploratores, longer-range scouts, and speculatores, who spied deeper within enemy territory. The Roman army also made use of local informers, indices, prisoners of war, deserters, and kidnapped civilians. If not the inventor of the system, Caesar may, nevertheless, be credited with professionalizing it and institutionalizing some of its most important features, notably the right of direct access by scouts to the commander in person. He also, when necessary, went to sea for himself, a dangerous but sometimes essential intervention. Ultimately, the crisis of the empire in the 4th century required the almost continuous presence of one of the emperors, there were latterly two, sometimes more, with the army, a contingency that at Adrianople in 378 led to his death on the field, progressive disaster and the empire's collapse. The Emperor Valens had been in close touch with his exploratores on the morning of the catastrophe, and they had correctly reported the enemy's strength and dispositions. What ensued substantiates a profound and enduring truth, that military and political survival does not depend solely on good intelligence. Systems do not, however, much change, unless circumstances change, and there was little circumstantial change throughout the 5 centuries of the Roman Empire's greatness, 1st century BC to 4th century AD. Reconnaissance throughout the period was by hearing and sight, communication by word of mouth or written dispatch, speed of transmission at fastest by that of a fleet-footed horse. What was true of Rome remained true of the world for another 1,500 years.